Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Patrick Kulikin, columnist for the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly. My co-host, as always, is Tobin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. The election is over. Even Florida has finished counting now. And while Nevada may be shifting toward becoming a so-called blue state, the Silver State voters showed that individual candidates still matter by choosing Barack Obama over Mitt Romney, but there are also the Republican Dean Heller over Democrat Shelley Berkley in the U.S. Senate race. To help us sort through the election results and what they mean for Nevada and the country, our guest today is Eric Herzig, a political scientist at the University of Nevada. He joins us by phone from Reno. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we have a split Senate delegation, a Republican governor, but the state voted for President Barack Obama, the Democrat, for the second time. Is Nevada turning less purple and more blue, or do you expect a GOP resurgence after this year's election?
Well, I think we're still fairly purple. I mean, you described, in a sense, the split of the delegation. And our congressional delegation is due to candidate quality matters. So I wouldn't make too much out of consecutive Democratic wins, just as in 2000 and 2004, Republicans had consecutive wins at the presidential level.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of the question, though, is perhaps more interesting. Will we see a resurgence of the Republican Party? I think one of the reasons, in fact, one of the main reasons the Democrats won this particular election and in 2008 was simply their better organization, really across the state and increasingly down the ballot. And the Republican Party, particularly in Clark County, is, shall we say, in disarray. And so the Republicans need to get a handle on this, and the Democrats need to sustain it.
Given that that big registration advantage that Democrats had, 90,000 active voters, more Democrats than Republicans, and I think there were also some inactive voters, meaning they were eligible, but they had moved, and I think the Democratic organization chased those voters as well. Do you think that that's a huge advantage? And that's why I guess that I ask why, whether or not the state may be becoming more blue than purple. But given that that state of things, are there actually Republicans out there who just aren't registered? I mean, you said that Democrats need to keep up that organizational advantage, Republicans need to catch up. Are there, do you think, a pile of Republican voters who the Republican Party needs to find and get registered and get to the polls?
Well, the Republican Party sure hopes so.
I mean, that's not generally true of Republicans, is it?
I don't know. And my gut instinct is there isn't as fertile of kind of hunting ground, so to speak, for new voters for Republicans as there are for Democrats. Democrats do better with younger voters. We've seen this now in the last couple of electoral cycles. They're very popular, say, on college campuses, when both in 2008 and 2012, the Obama organization, the Democrats, were very active, say, at UNR. I would guess that was true at UNLV. So the Republican Party needs to, in a sense, go find a message or develop a message that will convert many nonpartisans. And nonpartisans actually are growing faster in the state than either Democrats or Republicans. Now, who the nonpartisans are, we don't know. Are they disaffected Republicans who have walked away from a party that has become increasingly more conservative? Are they, in a sense, disaffected both Democrats and Republicans who just don't like partisan gridlock? We don't know. But when I say we, political science, we keep studying, trying to find this answer. And so the Republicans, I think, need to hone a message that will go, in a sense, maybe find some of those nonpartisans, maybe make a message that is, in a sense, more inviting to younger voters and also to Latino voters.
Okay. How do they do that?
Well,
I guess that's the million-dollar question. If you knew the answer, you'd be a rich man.
That's right. Or, well, people like Karl Rove and others will say, well, our message There's no problem with the Republican message. Well, I would beg to disagree. I mean, you're looking at a 90,000 vote registrant gap. And, I mean, some people have tried to minimize that and saying, oh, look, the numbers of Democrats between 08 and 12 actually went down by 6,000. What that misses is that in May of 12, at the start of this kind of electoral cycle, the Democratic registration lead had really fallen way down. And between May and October, the close of registration, you saw almost an 18% increase in the number of Democratic registrants. So that ground effort really paid off when they needed it. The Republicans just don't have that ground effort right now. Mm-hmm. In terms of developing a message, the Republican Party has not come up with a very inviting message. It's at one level has a very kind of mean cut to it, oftentimes saying, well, Latinos, you know, that's our natural, they're natural Republicans. You know, it's almost like if only they knew better, they would be Republicans. You generally don't recruit people into your party by, in a sense, insulting them, saying, hey, wake up, be smart, vote Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and when your lead on one of the key issues for, say, the Latino community on immigration ranges from self-deport to build a fence, you're really not, you have a non-starter with the fastest growing demographic group in the state. And so the Republican Party needs to figure out a message that isn't this just kind of in your face, we're just going to cut taxes and everybody else is, you know, a freeloading part of the 47%, that's a big problem that the Republicans have right now.
We need a kinder, gentler Republican Party.
Well, yeah, that's kind of a joke about that, but George Bush won as a compassionate conservative.
Uh-huh.
George Bush, in a sense, is often credited with authoring the Dream Act. Bush sought immigration reform,
mm-hmm.
and George Bush was no liberal. But within the Republican Party, when George Bush and also John McCain, back, say, in Bush's second term, talked about immigration reform, they became outcasts, in a sense, with many on the in the most conservative part of the Republican Party. So, I mean, yeah, we can make fun of the kind of compassionate, kinder, gentler Republican Party, but there is an aspect to that might have worked, that actually did work in terms of Bush doing better with Latinos.
Mm-hmm. Well, he being from Texas, along with his political operative, Karl Rove, they understood the direction things were moving, probably because they were from Texas, and they understood the way the demographic trends were going.
George Bush seemed, again, another irony, George Bush seemed to understand that. I think Karl Rove has completely forgotten it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, not only, you know, you have that with the demographic with Latino voters, you have a real problem with women voters. Republicans now are saying, "Oh, but with married women, we're doing just fine." Well,
but single women are one of the fastest growing segments of the population.
You got it again. I mean, single women are that's another fast growing demographic group. And mm-hmm. while you can hold your own maybe with married women as Republicans, the gap among single women was just overwhelmingly mm-hmm. against the Republican Party. Again, when your message has this hard edge where it wasn't just about abortion, but during the primary, particularly led by folks like Rick Santorum, you started getting back into a debate over contraception.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes the idea of choice to a whole new level, and a level that the Republicans are going to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was the website BuzzFeed ran a map last week. It was the electoral map if there had never been women's suffrage, which might be the secret hope of some people. But it was a different looking electoral map. The Republican Party would have swept the country if women couldn't vote. But I think that's obviously not a smart strategic way to look at the world, probably.
Well. And, well, you know, again, the sarcasm of, gee, you know, if only that women vote wasn't there. The worst news for the Republicans is that women make up more than 50% of the electorate now.
Right, right.
Women vote at higher rates than men.
Right.
And so you're swimming up the upstream against Latino voters, against single women voters, but also another growing demographic group is called seculars. And these are people who don't identify with any of, say, the mainstream religious denominations, but are not atheists. This is the fastest growing group of, I'll call them believers, because it's not really it's a religious group. I just don't have a good name for it except seculars, which is what demographers are using. This group is now second in the country only to Catholics. It's mm-hmm. larger than the evangelical bloc that is so core to the Republican Party. Again, Republicans lost this 70-30, and that's a growing demographic group. It's a group that is now younger. It's better educated. And, again, the message that the Republican Party is presenting with sometimes and often very rigid kind of social conservatism is just not going to play with this growing and younger group.
Mm-hmm. Now, I recall, it wasn't that long ago. It was only 2004 when I think there was some bad exit polling which had all of the pundits saying that the values voters were the most important bloc and that Republicans won them overwhelmingly and that what we were seeing was a changed electorate, a permanent Republican majority. It's only 8 years later, and now we're having a very different conversation. Is that because we're reading too much into this election, or has the country really changed that much in 8 years? There certainly is a large group of, I guess we'll call them millennials or Generation Y, what have you. They're a new group of voters. They certainly seem to have swung the country in a different direction. Or is this just an overreaction like the one we had in 2004?
You can certainly make too much out of this election, and that's a great cautionary note that you were saying. You look back. I think back in 2002, actually in the midterm when Republicans won seats, which is quite unusual in a midterm, that's when you heard this, the new permanent Republican majority. That also was a kind of unique election that people, in a sense, overanalyzed and overprojected going forward. I guess the items that I would look at are what demographic groups are growing and which ones are kind of consistently voting in a certain way. In 2004, value voters were very important. But in that election, Karl Rove and particularly the Republican Party were better at kind of micro-targeting their electorate, what the Democrats are now doing better than the Republicans. And they really targeted value voters, and especially in key swing states. And so going into that election, the polls showed, for instance, Florida and Virginia and North Carolina being very close. You know, people were talking about a repeat of 2000. But in fact, the Republicans had a very good ground game, had done a very good job micro-targeting the value voters, who are very strong in those three swing states. They win those swing states quite handily and, in a sense, move forward. The problem is the Republican ability to micro-target seems to have fallen on hard times. They also micro-targeted a group that has a hard cap on it, in a sense, the evangelical. There are only so many of them, and they already turn out. And so, you know, how much more yield can you get? The Democrats are micro-targeting and expanding whole new groups of voters, first-time voters, younger voters, single women, Latinos, where you have a lot of upside in terms of the number of potential voters that are out there. That, to me, is a trend that, particularly if I'm on the Republican side of the aisle, I'm looking at saying, we need to figure out an answer here.
And Eric, let's talk a little bit about the Senate race between Berkeley and Heller. Heller was one of those people who moderated, maybe dialed back a little bit of his more hardline stances on immigration during this campaign. And Berkeley lost by, 12,000 votes and was one of the last races called. I mean, do you think that – was it the ethics investigation that made the difference in this race, or was there more at play? Did Heller have a better game in Nevada going on than Romney on the ground?
I think the ethics issue was just too heavy a weight for Berkeley to overcome. I thought that Heller would win the race. I said that both Obama and Heller would win. I could imagine Obama-Heller voters. I can imagine no Romney-Berkeley voters. And so it was one of these where And also, Shelley Berkeley was simply invisible in outside of Clark County, and I think the numbers kind of show that. Dean Heller won the rurals by a margin that I don't think any Republican has ever won by, and that's saying a lot. He won Washoe County, where Obama won Washoe County by 6,000 votes. Heller won it by 22,000 votes. That's an incredible kind of flip, you know, 28,000 Obama-Heller voters, it appears. And I think part of that was Berkeley's just lack of a very viable campaign up north. I think that Heller got out early with the ethics attacks, and that really sold up north. I've commented on this before. There's a certain smugness. I can say that. I'm up here in the north. There's a certain smugness in the smaller part of the state. We look down at Clark County and say, oh, you know, that's just mean, dirty politics down there. Be careful, folks. And I think it played up north. I mean, you can make fun of that, call it provincial, whatever, but I don't think Berkeley ever got over that hurdle and ever got over the hurdle of that ethics investigation.
She just didn't have much appeal outside of Clark County, did she?
Yes, I would completely agree. Yeah. That, you know, at any level, whether it was party label, kind of personality, the issues, she just had a real problem. But mm-hmm. despite that, I mean, yeah, the election was one of the last ones to be called, and it was a 12,000 vote margin. And again, if I'm on the Republican side of the aisle, I'm looking at this going, Dean Heller did as well as a Republican can do in rural Nevada, where you can't milk any more votes out of there, and Washoe County, where he won by a wide margin, and he still almost lost. That, going forward, is another one of these red flags that I think the Republican Party needs to address.
And then, still speaking of that race, I mean, we had 45,000 voters choose none of these candidates, basically, and then and another 48,000 chose the, I would say, relatively unknown independent party candidate, David Vanderbeek. You know, what does that say about the voters' reaction to how this race was won, in your opinion? Run, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's twofold, and those are two very different groups. The none of the aboves, which was a very high number. I think those people were just fed up with the negativity of the Senate race. They didn't talk about issues very much. I mean, Dean Heller's lead card and about only card in this campaign was Shelley Berkeley's unethical. I mean, I joked about it as kind of content-free election for Dean Heller. He would come on and say, Shelley Berkeley's unethical. I believe in pragmatic solutions. Oh, by the way, did I mention Shelley Berkeley's unethical? And then Berkeley would come in, and you know, she kind of manufactured some ethics issues linked to Dean Heller. I thought most of those were a stretch. And then said, you know, he's in the pocket of big oil. He doesn't work for you. And
Medicare.
And it just, I think a lot of people just watched it and said, I want a do-over. I don't like either one of these candidates. Now, the independent Americans, the argument from the conservative side of the Republican Party is, well, that shows you that Dean Heller should never have moderated his views. I mean, those are people who, Dean Heller was not a true conservative. How dare he, you know, as you said, he seemed to moderate his views, move to the center.
Do you think that he
tried to do that.
Do you think that... So I guess the argument is that he should have won those 48,000 votes who voted for Vanderbeek, but he moderated and therefore they ran to the right to the alternative.
I think that's in part true. I won't say for that entire population.
My question is: are there a lot of voters, including some Obama voters, who it's when you see Independent American Party, it sure sounds good.
Yeah.
And I don't think people realize that what that is. It's a sort of Hansen family political operation that's a little wacky. And you think, am I right there? Or
no, I think you're right. When people register, because to register, you have to register nonpartisan, not independent,
right.
To not be one either Democrat or Republican. And so you see Independent American. And as you say, well, God, that sounds really good.
Yeah.
Until you read what's beyond the label,
right.
And then you're right. I mean, it's a very, you know, far right kind of social conservatives. I mean, it grew quite a bit. I mean, they gained 10,000 registrants in the last year. Part of that might have been a mistake. Part of it were disaffected, very conservative Republicans. This is a problem for the Republican Party. It's like if Dean Heller takes a step towards the center, you'll have a small group, and I will emphasize, a small group say, well, you know, we might as well just have two liberal parties. And that's a fight that's going to happen in the Republican Party.
Professor Herzig, let's talk about candidate recruitment and the Democratic bench. With term limits now in the legislature, you have a lot more churn and turnover, and the Democrats seem to have lost off its roster now. Shelley Berkley, her career is likely finished, as is that of a former Assembly Speaker or outgoing Assembly Speaker John Asagera. Talk about that that issue of developing a bench and candidate recruitment for both parties.
Well, this may be one of those unintended consequences of term limits. I mean, people have to come in, make a name for themselves in a hurry, and then they're often pushed to go to the next level sooner than they may be ready, or the timing may not be right. And so I think this is a problem not just for Democrats, but for Republicans as well. The good news for the Democrats, I guess, is you do have a couple people in statewide offices, Ross Miller and Catherine Cortez Masto, who I think, you know, certainly aspire to higher or different offices. And so the Democrats have two people there. Kate Marshall could be put in that group, although I think she hurt herself badly in her loss up here in Congressional District 2.
I think so. I certainly will have a long memory on that race.
Yeah, that was one where the odds were against her to begin with, but uh-huh. Then she ran a very bad campaign.
And sucker punched the president repeatedly.
Yes. I don't quite understand. Well, I understand, in a sense, why she jumped. I agree with you, some of the things she said about trying to fit into that district, which I think alienated a lot of Democrats and certainly didn't win over any Republicans.
Yeah, I had Democrats, pretty prominent Democrats, up in that district who told me after I wrote about the race and my own frustrations with the treasurer that they had given her money and they were hoping to get it back. I don't think they're going to, but...
I don't think they're going to, but yeah, that was a level of frustration.
Yeah.
I think you're exactly right. And so, you know, let's take her out. You still got the two statewide folks. When you get down into the state legislature, though, you had Barbara Buckley, who I thought, you know, whether you agree with her policy positions or not, I thought she was an excellent speaker. I mean, she did something during the Gibbons administration that I didn't think could be done in Nevada politics when, you know, the budget's delivered and she just said, this isn't going to work, we're going to completely redo it. Had to get it done not in 120 days, but 116 days because of the potential veto. Gets it done. I mean, knockdown, drag out with the governor at the time. Again, whether you like it or not, that's quite an accomplishment. But then she rolls in and loses her primary and seems to have just dropped off the stage. And I think that hurts the Democrats as well. This was an up-and-coming person who's just gone. I think Rory mm-hmm. Reid's gone. You're right about John Asagera, but I think he was pretty damaged goods rolling into that CD3 race to begin with. And so the Democrats have some gaps. They're going to have to work in finding the person to bring forward. But I'm looking at the Republican bench, and it's not very deep either. Again, might be term limits. And I'm trying to think, hey, you've got at the top of the ticket, you have Brian Sandoval. Okay, he's kind of, he's the star that the Republicans can always point to. But then you start going down, and it's like, okay, who do we have next? And there's not a lot of experience there.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the state Senate, and where Republicans won three of the five competitive races, but they fell short. Do we just chalk that up to, again, that registration disadvantage they faced?
Registration, also, that was one of the few bright spots for the Republicans. they didn't get the fourth one that they needed, but they won in a couple of districts where the registration advantage actually tipped to the Democrats. And up here, CD15, I believe the first $1 million state senate race in Nevada history, between Greg Brower and Sheila Leslie.
Mm-hmm.
They retained that seat, but that's a district that has become far more balanced. I mean, when Raggio had it, it was overwhelmingly Republican. Now it's a slight Republican registration lead. There's a double sweetness that for the Republicans is that they take out Sheila Leslie. Sheila is another one of these people that you may disagree with her specific politics. I do. I'll make that clear, but you have to respect her as a legislator. She was hardworking, well-informed, did the work for the party.
Probably the most forceful liberal voice in the legislature.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not there, but I have to respect it. I mean, she was just a good legislator. But now she's gone, and I think that's a big hit for the Democrats in terms of their leadership going forward, and somebody's going to have to fill that void. But so that the Republicans got the three, but not the fourth one to flip that 11-10 margin their way.
Mm-hmm. And Eric, I wanted to ask you, obviously one of the big stories leading up all through the campaign season and then after the election was Hispanic voter turnout, which was record numbers and record proportion of the total electorate. And as going forward, now that Heller does have a 6-year term, could certainly be helped moving forward by, solidifying some more Hispanic voters in this sort of purple state that we've been talking about. Do you think he's a prime candidate to maybe be a GOP leader in terms of negotiations on comprehensive immigration reform, which seems to have picked up some steam with Obama's victory?
Well, it may be presumptuous of me to say this, but in a sense, Dean Heller is now positioned. He needs to step up. He's a nice guy who ran a kind of lackluster campaign, but I'm not Shelley Berkeley. All right, you now have a 6-year term. You're not going to face the voters for a while. One of the key issues in this state, and particularly that the Republican Party has to deal with, is immigration, as you highlight. If Dean Heller doesn't step up and get outside of kind of this rigid Republican box that, when you watch the presidential primary debates, and Rick Perry, who I won't hold up as kind of an intellectual leader of the party, says, you build a 20-foot fence, you're just going to sell a lot of 20-foot ladders. And Newt Gingrich shoots back and says, well, then we need to, build two fences. That's going nowhere with Latino voters, and I would say with many nonpartisans who are looking for some sort of, can we get beyond the rhetoric? I would hope that Dean Heller would step up and, you're going to have to take a chance here. Somebody in the Republican Party is going to have to take a chance here. It's an ideal issue for Heller to take on, and we'll see if he does.
All right, we're out of time. We really want to thank you and our political scientist, Eric Herzig, for joining us today. You've been listening to Neon Eden on KUNV 91.5. We want to thank our producer, Stephen Zeller. My co-host is Tovin Lapan. I'm J. Patrick Kulik, and catch us next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.